Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
My name is Stephen Lerner, and I'm a fellow at the Georgetown's CalManifest Initiative for Labor and the Working Poor, and I work in the hedge clipper and bank workers in a number of different campaigns that are all focused on looking up the money tree about who's really running the politics and economy of the country.
All right. And so let's start with the bank workers, because the bank workers just kicked off a union drive at a big international bank. So tell us about what's happening with the bank workers and how that connects back to the financial crisis.
So the bank workers campaign is really interesting, because what most people don't realize is banks in most countries in the world are significantly unionized. And so we have a three-pronged campaign. One has been broadly building worker committees in banks in the United States. And one of the first real victories of that is the Bank Workers Campaign, the Committee for Better Banks, with CWA, and a whole series of community groups, which we can come back to, were the whistleblowers on the Wells Fargo scandal. And so there's they're opening fake accounts. So there's an ongoing growing campaign with workers in all the major U.S. banks. But what we're focusing on now is a bank called Santander, which is a Spanish-owned bank, which is, again, is union in most countries in the world and heavily unionized in Brazil and Argentina, completely unionized. So we've in the United States are primarily a Northeastern bank, but they also a big national subprime auto lender. And so we have a campaign there, and there's now a global demand on the bank that they agree not to fight the union and be neutral and have the same posture to the union in the United States as they do in other countries. And what was really exciting on the kickoff and sort of unheard of is, in addition to traditional solidarity actions, letters and pickets in Argentina and Brazil, workers actually walked off the job and did shutdowns of bank branches and other centers, demanding the bank not interfere with workers' right to organize a union in the United States.
Yeah. And so talk about the way that why is unionized bank workers good for people, and how do they help prevent financial crises, for instance?
What's been fascinating about the campaign, both here in the United States and bank workers and the other unions, is there's always been a dual demand, the traditional demand about how workers should be paid and treated decently, but simultaneously that workers should not be forced to sell predatory products or cheap customers as a condition of employment. And what we've argued is that bank workers, in the same way in a hospital, a nurse is a front line on quality care, that bank workers can be the front line on making sure banks aren't cheating and robbing people. And that's why the work with Wells Fargo has been so exciting, because it's bank workers who for years, literally tens of thousands of workers have signed petitions saying these outrageous sales goals could only be met if they cheated workers. So one part is workers as whistleblowers, workers as a front line in saying what the bank is doing is bad. And then as workers, we don't want to participate in a scheme where the bank makes money by cheating people.
This is one of the things that's interesting about this, is that the connection with these international bank workers and the international unions that represent bank workers. And this is, you know, when we talk about globalization and we talk about jobs moving around the world and sort of progressive solutions to Trump's nationalism, international campaigns like this are a really interesting starting point. I wonder if you want to talk about that at all.
Yeah, as someone who's done a lot of organizing where we ask unions in other countries to support workers in the United States who are organizing global companies, what's unique about the bank worker organizing is the Brazilian bank workers, which are the biggest bank workers union in the world and one of the most progressive, has aggressively and wonderfully called on the American labor movement to organize bank workers. And it's not just out of solidarity. They have this view that they cannot maintain the standards they've won in Brazil and around the world if the largest country with the biggest finance industry is non-union. So it's a little almost hallucinogenic to have workers in so-called developing countries say that their wages and benefits are threatened by the level of non-union stuff in the United States. So there's this fantastic group, both with led by the Brazilian bank workers and UNI, the Global Bank Worker Federation, that is working both to support the campaign and pressurize the company, but also around the globe has lifted up this call, which I think is really unusual for unions, about workers not being pressured to cheat people as a condition of employment. And so there's been meetings all over the world on this and a real commitment to doing concrete stuff to pressure the bank. We're going to be going to the Santander shareholder meeting in Spain. And then the other thing that we've been doing, we've done a series of reports that have been exposing Santander's bad practices, ranging from their role in both, and we can come back to this in more detail, but their role in the Puerto Rican debt crisis, their role in subprime auto. They just failed their CRA test, and we did a report on that. So we, again, are building the campaign not just about what's good for workers, but how what's good for workers will make the company healthier in terms of how it engages with customers and consumers.
Yeah, explain, actually, because the Community Reinvestment Act thing is very interesting. Explain what just happened with that.
Well, essentially, you know, Community Reinvestment Act requires, in simplest terms, you know, banks to provide resources to the communities that they're in, to invest in them. And we did a report first that showed that their lending practices, you know, their lending practices ignored or skipped over poor communities and communities of color. And then they just failed. There's a test that's done under the CRA Act to see if you've given enough money or loaned enough money, and the bank failed it. And, you know, we think this is, and then the bank also failed the stress test. And so we think there's a relationship between mistreatment of workers, how people are pressurized, and then the banks actually, the underpinnings of the bank being threatened because they're engaged in all sorts of risky practices that may make them a little bit of money on the short run, but then blow up in their face in the long run.
We will come back to Puerto Rico, but I do want to talk about expanding this out a little bit because you work with hedge flippers and other groups. And one of the things that connects a lot of this work is really mapping where the power and the money comes from for bad policies and bad politicians. And those are policies that are bipartisan, we should say. But so in the age of Trump in particular, I'm going to talk about the importance of this kind of work and why it's important to know who is funding your politicians and funding your policies and destroying your community, et cetera, et cetera.
The Hedge Clippers campaign, for folks who don't know, is a campaign that looks at hedge funds and private equity, thus hedge clippers clipping their power, and basically says these are the finance capitalists that are driving political and economic inequality. And what we've done is both deep dive reports, exposés, lots of direct action to directly confront them. And what I'd say, our joke is that we've either been our sick joke, incredibly prescient, or Trump picked his entire cabinet by looking at who we've been fighting. And so I think pre-Trump winning, we were saying these are the people, whether it's Goldman Sachs or Steve Schwarzman from Blackstone, or I'll go through a list of names later, these are the people who are really running the government. And lots of folks would laugh and almost say we were conspiratorial and we were like a conspiracy cult or something. And then when Trump got elected, he put all these people directly in charge. And it's sort of an irony that Trump's election is probably the best testimony to the idea that whether Dems or Republicans, this set of players is who are really running the show. And so we're doing a lot of work on mapping the different Trump worlds. So there's the people like Mnuchin and the Goldman Sachs folks that are directly in the administration. And how do you map all the benefits that their companies will reap from that? Then there's the Steve Schwartzmans and the Carl Icahns and this other set of players that, you know, run committees for him. And so that they essentially can create government policy that will further enrich their companies. And then there's a third set of people, like John Paulson, who made all his money in the housing crisis, who may not be directly working for Trump, but who supported him and now are going to reap the benefits. For example, he's heavily invested in Puerto Rico. So what we've been looking at is how do you identify the corporate collaborators with Trump? And then look at ways to start putting pressure on them so that they pay a price for the fact that they're in bed with Trump.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and how do they pay the price for being in bed with Trump, I guess, is the next question, right?
Well, so one thing is that many of these folks who are in bed with Trump have significant investments from public employee pension plans and college endowments.
Right.
And so we've been ongoing running a campaign saying that pension funds and endowments basically are getting lousy deals from these guys, meaning they pay a lot of money to invest in them and they get lousy returns. So we're going to escalate that, but we're also going to look at some of the hedge funds that have really atrocious policies and raise the issue that colleges and pension plans shouldn't invest in racist companies. So, for example, this guy Mercer, who owns part of, or his family owns part of Breitbart, their Cambridge Analytics, you know, the secret polling apparatus for Trump. I think it's Providence, the city of Providence is invested, Rhode Island is invested, you know, in one of his funds. So we want to start raising the issue for a bunch of these people that we should cut off their capital and we shouldn't basically public dollars or the dollars of progressive institutions shouldn't be invested in them. So one thing is cutting off their capital. Another thing we're doing is we've been introducing legislation on a state-by-state basis to tax the carried interest exemption. This is a loophole that lets them take their regular income that most people pay 30 or 35% on, and they get to pay 15%. I won't bore you with the detail of how they do it, except it's an $18 billion a year tax loophole. We think taxing it on a state level, on the one hand, in New York, it would produce $3.7 billion in revenue, but the other thing it does is it cuts off their cap. One of the reasons they can give so much money politically is because they have a special tax loophole that gives them $18 billion in cash to play with. So one of the ways we can hurt them is cutting off tax breaks and cutting off investment. And I think there's sort of a sweet irony of their greed and getting in bed with Trump may make them much more susceptible to cutting off their capital. So that's one thing. Another thing I think was really illustrated on the CWA Momentum strike, which was a long strike in upstate New York. And when people realized that Blackstone's Steve Schwartzman had been involved in investing in the company and focused on him, it changed the nature of the strike. Because instead of it being an isolated battle, it was Trump's job czar is actually involved in cutting wages, benefits, and outsourcing work. So I think focusing, and this is one of the pieces that I think is the most critical, which is showing that the people that Trump has put in charge, like Wilbur Ross, et cetera, are actually job destroyers. So we want to completely change the story from, by putting the spotlight on them, by saying these are actually the people who got rich destroying good jobs. It's not evil foreigners or immigrants. It's these guys. And so then that lets you raise a whole set of issues in terms of showing who they are and then all the different ways that they game the system to enrich themselves at the expense of workers.
Right, right. And this goes back to work that you were doing before the financial crisis within SEIU, right?
Yeah, going back to SEIU in, I think, 2007, we looked at the private equity industry and realized that if you look at the companies they own, which are called portfolio companies, that 6 of the 10 largest employers in the United States are private equity companies. And most people don't know that there's this giant monstrosity at the top that actually owns it. And so what gets really interesting is if you look at a company like Blackstone, they own hotels, they own manufacturing, they're the biggest apartment owner in the country now, that it lets you look at how you might campaign on them on multiple levels. You can campaign by organizing their non-union workers. You know, this is what you get for being in the Trump, amen chorus, if everybody looks more deeply at your company. So they own retail outlets, they own apartments, they are tax avoiders. So I think there's an incredible opportunity, to use the word of the day, intersectional, to say to a whole set of different groups, this guy is actually, you know, they're in oil and gas. They are so dominant in the economy. Why not focus all our energy on a couple of these characters as a way to both build a broader movement, but also tell the story about how they use their wealth to game the system. And the more they game the system, the richer they get. I mean, I think Schwarzman is worth $11 billion. And just had his 70th birthday party where they spent tens of millions. And it also lets you tell the story of, you know, the grotesqueness of these people. And it was so fascinating to find workers, some of whom were voted for Trump, are sort of stunned when they find out that the guys destroying their jobs are who Trump has put in charge.
Yeah, and there has been this campaigning has been going on around the Dakota Access Pipeline with people and cities, in fact, divesting from Wells Fargo and other banks that are invested in that pipeline.
Yeah, and this is another example, and we'll come to some more in Puerto Rico. So Wells Fargo workers exposed how they were cheating consumers, but there's now a campaign called Fargo Wells. And surprise, surprise, there's a website, fargowells.org. And what it's saying is, let's look at the totality of the sins of Wells Fargo. So they treat their workers terribly. They rob consumers. They're a funder of the Dakota Access Pipeline. They fund private prisons. They fund, in some way, payday lending. And again, the idea here is saying, you know, there's an unlimited number of bad guys out there. But why don't we get whatever your issue is, let's pile on a couple of the most dominant players. And remember that Elaine Chao, head of transportation, she was on the board of Wells Fargo during all of the scandals. So again, you know, what you basically have is one of the board members of Wells Fargo now in the Trump cabinet. And this company captures almost everything that's wrong with what's going on in this country. And, you know, one of the most extraordinary things that sort of captures the obscenity of Wells Fargo, they have binding arbitration. So if you have an account with them, you automatically give up the right to sue them. So when they illegally opened up accounts for people, when people attempted to sue about that, the illegally opened account, the bank said, well, your legally opened account has a binding arbitration procedure, therefore you can't sue us on the illegally opened account. You're following me? I mean, it's like you can't make this stuff up.
Right.
And so I think a big part of our work is basically saying Trump has surrounded himself with these set of players. That is who they really are. And then let's look at all the ways they screw people and are the opposite of Trump. And I guess the way I think about it, what he claims to believe, but the way I think about it is Trump, we have to make Trump guilty of every evil and sin they commit. Trump,
yeah.
If Trump picked Elaine Child and he's supporting fake accounts, he's supporting all these things. And on the other hand, anybody who associates with Trump has to be guilty of all his sins. So Jamie Dimon from J.P. Morgan and Lloyd Blankfein from Goldman Sachs like to pretend they're at least social progressives. But
right.
Gary Cohn, who's the Goldman Sachs guy who went over to the administration, stood behind Trump when he signed the Muslim ban. So we now need to hold, hold Goldman Sachs accountable. Goldman Sachs and their people are behind anti-immigrant and Muslim bashing. So I think there's like a fantastic opportunity to force these contradictions, drive some wedges in the ruling class, and really tell the story about what used to be secret is now public. These are the guys
right.
who are running both the economy and the government.
Right, right. So let's get to Puerto Rico because, we've talked, and some people at least who are reading or listening to this are familiar with what went on in Greece and other countries that were on that got the short end of the austerity agenda. But so Puerto Rico is a little bit closer to home because it's not the EU and the World Bank, but it's our government who is doing this to Puerto Rico with the help of all of these same people that we've just been talking about. So, yeah, talk about that situation and what we need to learn from it.
So before I get into the detail of Puerto Rico, I think the way to think about this is that globally, first with the IMF, they took developing countries and basically used the shock doctrine to devastate the economies of those countries and enforce austerity. Then they've experimented in Greece and other countries on basically how you enforce austerity and overrule democratic rule over. And now, we've already done, we are using the United States. We're experimenting with the same thing, which is how you purposely make a place broke. Then when it's broke, you say, we need to put an emergency control board and get rid of democratic rule. And then once you get rid of democratic rule, you basically turn it into a paradise for the rich. So the story they would tell is that, the Puerto Rico borrowed $70 billion, is hopelessly in debt, and now they need, like the Greeks, to pay the piper and pay the money back.
Right.
But what's so fascinating about Puerto Rico, and there's so many examples of it, is the first thing is Puerto Rico didn't borrow $70 billion. Puerto Rico, with the help of Santander Bank and Goldman Sachs, did a series of loans that are essentially the equivalent of a payday loan for a country.
Uh-huh.
So one of the loans they did, they borrowed $3.5 or $4 billion. This is all on the Refund America site. But the payback is $33 billion. And it was essentially how a loan was created that could be hidden off the books because you don't pay the money for years. So you borrow $4 billion, you owe $33 billion. And so the banks and hedge funds knowingly created loans that created huge profits for them that Puerto Rico couldn't pay back. And they're essentially, the best way to think about them is as a payday loan. And so one of the best examples of this is Santander Bank, who we talked about earlier, was the underwriter for many, many of these loans. And they made huge profits on it, and they were in the middle of that. What the federal government has done is set up a control board to basically enforce austerity in Puerto Rico. The two head principal guys of the control board are from Santander Bank. So the guys that basically created the debt and the loans and got rich on it now are adjudicating that the only way to fix the economy is cuts that are actually greater than in Greece.
Right.
And so you have this crazy group of people who first got rich on the loans, and now they're the ones who are deciding who gets paid and doesn't get paid. And essentially the issue in Puerto Rico, like almost everywhere, is why should banks and hedge funds and others get paid mega returns when the result of that is the devastation of the island. The only other thing I'd add, and if you want to go into it more, is they've also adopted a thing where basically if a millionaire lives there part-time, they don't have to pay any tax. So they're creating an economy where the rich pay almost no tax, where the taxes for everybody else goes up dramatically, and then the entire and now they're moving in on lowering the minimum wage, and their real goal is to turn Puerto Rico into a playground for the super rich.
Yeah, yeah. And so, again, these are things that obviously the same people that we've been talking about, but Puerto Rico's relationship with the U.S. is a, well, it's a colony, but it's in your U.S. media. And so, you know, I don't know, this was all passed under the Obama administration. And so what can we expect from Trump on this front? I mean, nothing good, I assume, but.
Yeah, I think what we can expect, I mean, I think this finally happened, that the Puerto Rican government has actually hired, what was his, like, Corey Lewandowski, or who's the guy that was Trump's?
Lewandowski?
Yeah, they hired him. To try to open doors on the Hill, what has been reported.
You've got to be kidding me. That's
and
so funny.
What I think
it's horrifying, but funny.
Yeah, I mean, but let me go back a second. John Paulson, who I brought up earlier, who's an early Trump supporter and who made his $15 billion on the housing crisis, is buying up hotels and property all over Puerto Rico and getting them at a discount. And so I think the first thing to realize is a bunch of people that are in the Trump world either are buying property there or own, have investments and hedge funds there. So they all want to maximize how much they're going to get. And I think you could imagine in the bill that created the control board, you know, there were certain things that were supposed to protect pensions and other things. I think you could imagine, you know, all of that getting much worse, whether it's just in climate or in actually changing the law. But this idea that that the creditors and the banks and the rich, you know, this isn't trickled. I don't know if you could even call this the theory of trickle down, that rewarding them is going to fix the economy is insane. But I think under Trump, it will just be worse, because at least in the old administration, there was the rhetoric of we have to create a sustainable economy. And in this case, there's no illusion. And, you know, the island is just increasingly going to be depopulated as people flee to the United States in the search of work.
And then, at least people coming from Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens, but
I don't know if you saw that in Chicago. There was a Puerto Rican citizen of the United States was held for 3 days by ICE or the Border Patrol because they didn't believe he was a citizen. So that will be.
Yeah, and it's you know, it's worth noting that this the Puerto Rico situation is particular, but that many of the people who are coming to this country to find jobs are doing it because we more or less did something similar to their countries at some point or another.
I think that's exactly right. And there's two things I've heard that are interesting. You know, one, at the turn of the last century, people talked about how it was big sugar and agriculture and all that basically sucked all the money out of Puerto Rico, and now it's finance that's playing that role. But I think the key thing about Puerto Rico is this is an experiment happening in a colony or territory of the United States that they want to export, which is you make lots of money driving a place into bankruptcy, then you seize control of it through control boards. This is Flint. This is Detroit. And then once you're in control, you not only suck more money out through austerity, but you then create a system that puts corporations completely in control. You know, you privatize everything. Part of the law in Puerto Rico not only says you can go under the U.S. minimum wage. It also says that you don't have to do environmental impact statements. You can just, like, build stuff more quickly. So I think the reason people should care about Puerto Rico is, one, because it's horrific as a humanitarian and economic crisis, but this is the beginning of what they would like to do in Chicago, what they would like to do in all sorts of places here, which is significantly in communities of color, finding ways to gain complete control of the economy and the politics.
And this actually connects to the last thing we were going to talk about, because we were talking in email about people want to talk about Germany and Italy and fascism and Nazism, and certainly we have people like Richard Spencer walking around and Steve Bannon in the White House. It is important to know our global history, but also we need to know our own history and some of the lessons for fighting Trump come from, and for understanding what Trump is doing, come from things that happened in the past. And you had mentioned the Palmer raids in 1919, 1920, where everybody's favorite person, J. Edgar Hoover, cut his teeth. And then the 40s and 50s, the beginning of the civil rights movement and fighting against the Jim Crow South. So I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about what the lessons that we are missing right here at home are.
So the first part I'd say is, because I'm so fascinated by this, I'm going to do a bunch of reading to make sure I know a lot more than I know right now. But the starting point that I think you really hit on is there's this a little bit of this rhetoric and sort of shock that how could this happen in America? How could we have immigrant bans? How could we have this? How could we have this out of control racism? And in some ways, it's kind of bizarre, because we don't need to look to Germany or Italy. We just need to look to our own past. And in many ways, this is as American as apple pie.
Right.
And so if you think back 100 years to, that both the pre- and post-World War I period, you had a very fascinating set of things happening. It's one, you had, sort of the growing industrialization that, totally changed labor management relationships. Instead of crafts, you had, growing giant factories. You had huge immigration. You had growing left movements. And when you look at the reaction to that, it was, vilifying of immigrants, of communists and socialists and anarchists. It was, I'm trying to remember where the strike was. It was a huge strike out west where they literally put everybody in boxcars and deported them. And so I think what's fascinating about that period is, one, how the state used its apparatus to attack the left and immigrants and to create the fear of, then it wasn't Islam. It was, evil foreigners and communists and all that. But the level of repression was extraordinary. But the other part of it is the level of resistance and, the giant steel strikes and what year was it that the LA Times got blown up by the McNamara brothers?
I do not know.
It's actually worth reading about, is that there was incredible class conflict. And there's a book that Joseph McCartan from Georgetown wrote, and I'm just reading, so I can't fully say what it says, but partly what he talks about is the battle.
LA Times was apparently blown up on October 1st, 1910.
I did not know this. That it's a famous case because Clarence Darrow was the attorney, and it was the Iron Workers Union, and everybody said it was a frame, and then basically they said, yes, we did do it. They admitted they did it anyway.
But
to capture that, the intensity of struggle, people didn't say, oh, the state apparatus is really bad or people might get deported. There were huge strikes. This is actually when the ACLU was founded under a different name in that period. So I think looking at that both gives us a window into the kind of repression, particularly American, that we'll face, but also what people did in response. And what Joe McCartan argues in his book is even though many of the big, big strikes and things were lost in that period, he refers to it as the dress rehearsal for the CIO. That, that those battles and the relationship people made and what people learned in those fights created the consciousness and the relationships and an understanding of the system that made it possible, for people then to, to engage in even, during the Depression and post-Depression mass struggle. So I just think that's an area that we need to look at, both as guidance to what they would do and then guidance about the importance of directly confronting and fighting it. You know, when I, on the South, it's actually, if you think about the 40s and 50s and Jim Crow, it is, it was an apartheid state where the rule, so-called rule of law was, irrelevant. And the struggle of both black workers and union campaigns, the struggle against that, I think one again shows, we don't need to think of Germany or Italy. I mean, whether it's lynchings and shootings and jailings, one is the kinds of things that we may face, but more importantly than that, also that if people hadn't stood up to that at tremendous risk in the darkest of times, that created the conditions that allowed the civil rights movement to grow later. You know, people forget that the civil rights movement didn't just, Rosa Parks sat on the bus and everything happened, that there were years of deep organizing and struggle. So I think looking at those two periods is helpful in understanding what's happened in America in the past and then also how fighting it sets the stage for victories later.
How can people keep up with you and with the organizations that you mentioned here?
So a couple things. So one is there's a group called littlesis.org, littlesis.org, which, as they say, they're the opposite of Big Brother. They're looking from the bottom up at the powerful versus.
Yeah.
And they are doing fantastic work on mapping, the variety of things, of the relationships of Trump, they're creating a toolkit that will soon be available to everybody in the country to map the sort of dirty dozen in each state of corporate collaborators with Trump. So I think one is to look at Little Sis, both on their website and on Facebook and all that. I mean, on Twitter. The other is hedgeclippers.org, has now 45 reports on the evildoers, and we'll have more, but also is sponsoring all sorts of direct action and other campaigns and divestment. There's also the Refund America project, which is refundamerica.org, that Stock and Body and Maurice Weeks run, which is really looking at Puerto Rico and municipal debt. And then there's bargainingforthecommongood.org, which is a campaign where unions and community groups are going to the bargaining table together and saying, in addition to decent wages and benefits, we want to bargain about bigger political and economic issues in our community. So there's, and then my name is Stephen Lerner. So you can follow me on Twitter if you want to. But the point being that there's, I think there, the moment that we're in, I think, is how do we pick out a couple of corporations that are tied to Trump and are simultaneously intersect all different movements? And how do we, instead of just marching on government buildings that don't care, and instead that we yell at them, and instead of just marching on Trump's buildings, how do we pick a set of people and a set of companies and people within those companies and really focus in on what they're doing and look at ways that not just embarrasses them, but we cut off their capital and really impact their businesses and say, instead of, on the one hand, you may in the short run get rich off of your dealings with Trump, but in the long run, you're planting the seeds for your own destruction.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.